Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
I'm Lydia Saldana with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, and we are sitting here in Rockport in Chuck Neiser's living room along with our friend David Sykes. Usually I ask our guests to introduce themselves, but today I'm going to ask you to introduce each other. So Chuck, tell us about David Sykes.
Well, is this going to be censored or can I just free flow?
No editing.
David Sykes is the outdoor writer for the Caller Times at Corpus Christi. He's been a longtime friend, critic, supporter, confidant in many areas of coastal life, and been a huge reason Flatsworthy has been accepted in this area. I can't introduce him as anything other than a friend. He might not like that, but.
Let's see what he says about you.
Okay.
David, introduce Chuck.
Can I leave?
Well, the universal definition of Chuck is that he's the godfather of fly guides in Texas. He commands a level of respect that was required to start this movement. And I believe that by any other captain, it would not have worked nearly as well. He's dedicated to a cause that he is hell-bent on making his legacy, and I am right there behind him. I will support everything he does. There's no such thing as a misstep when your heart's where his is.
Well, that just opens the door to let's go ahead and talk about Flatsworthy.
I hate that because that's about a $500 answer he gave.
For those of our listeners who don't know what Flatsworthy is, tell us about Flatsworthy and why it started. We'll talk about the project that we did today a little bit later in the conversation. Let's just start with what is Flatsworthy?
Well, David and I have both been in these waters a long time. I go back, I first came here in 1967. And you see change and you see circumstance, and I saw conflict that was gaining too much momentum between the different user groups. And I'd been involved quite closely with the legislation that was passed to get redfish and trout declared game fish. And I know how hard legislation is to come to fruition. So I just said we have to do something outside of the legislative effort, and the only thing to do is get all the user groups together and let's talk about what we're doing. And so I gathered up a representative from each facet of fishing here in Rockport, and we held a meeting and we just said, look, we need to work this out ourselves. We need to talk about it. We need to come together. This is a 6 to 8 year project, and we have to stay the course. And that's what it is. It's a movement. And all along the way, you have little victories and little defeats, and you just put them behind you and go to the next step.
And David, you were there at that first meeting. You've observed kind of what's happened over the last couple of years. What are your observations about that?
Well, I think it's got a core group that will make the momentum continue. It's like Chuck said, you know, you take two steps back and one step, or two steps forward and one step back every now and then. But I think that the real core of courtesy on the water and getting along and more or less acting like responsible adults is something that resonates with all anglers, at least in public. And I mean, you have to have someone to stand up and say these things. I think it's admirable from the beginning, Chuck rejected any of the organizations, the nonprofits that may have wanted to attach their name to this group. And he said, no, that's just gonna divide us. And he doesn't want any legislation. He's not trying to tell people what to do. He's trying to say, don't you think this is what we should do? And then everyone would buy into it. And obviously the buy-in is what I've been trying to garner the whole time, is to show people that it's the reasonable thing to do for sustainable conservation. And that's why Chuck is the ambassador, is that people go, well, if Chuck says it's so, then it's probably reasonable. It's hard to argue with reason.
Well, they're those that want to do that. So,
they
but,
do.
You know,
they
it's,
do.
It's my target is 60% of the people, and get them on into our way of thinking, and let the 40% come in slowly. That's the only way. You can't expect everybody to believe in what you're doing. Who am I to say I'm right? I mean, I'm not so self-centered that I can say I'm the God and everything I say is right. You know, it's just a simple deal. Every user group uses this resource in a different way. And in the course of you using it your way, if you do things that hamper the next person, don't do it. Go do your thing. Don't hurt the other angler. Don't hurt the kayaker. Don't hurt the wade fisherman. Don't hurt the airboater. Just go do your deal. Be
nice.
Efficient in the way that you're doing it, and it's going to be automatically better. And you haven't hurt yourself in any way.
Well, and part of this, you know, is the increase in pressure, both in numbers of folks out here, and then the diversity in the way people are enjoying the resource. And Chuck, you've been fishing here in Rockport. I mean, I know you've lived here since, what, 92? But you've been fishing in Rockport since when?
1967.
Okay. So what was it like back then, and how is it different today?
Well, that's a really interesting thing. I think about that a lot. When I came here in 67, there wasn't anybody else. I could go to Carlos Bay, which we did, on July 4th weekend, go spend the night, flounder, and honestly never see another boat. Never. I mean, it's just like having the whole thing to yourself, and I did. And I didn't know it at the time, but when I started guiding, I got a degree in biology, so, I mean, you start thinking in terms of the habitat and the past, and, you know, you see the future from looking at the past. And I always wonder, one of the burning questions was, what did the Indians see? What did the Cronco Indians see? And I just envied that. I just wanted to see what it was like when there were no lights, there was no power, there was nobody else, you had a campsite. And I found campsites, and I love to go look in them, and not on the refuge, because that's illegal, but there are places that you, but you know, it's a very interesting thing. But so I lamented the fact that they saw something that was pure and I didn't. And then I went and I fished, when I started guiding, I fished in 92, 3, 4, and there basically wasn't anybody else here. So I went and observed inside San Jose Island. I observed fish movement unaffected by other people. We were waiting. The other day I was talking to a friend who has taken some of my writings and working it into his book. And I came to the realization I was one of the last people that saw what the Indians saw. The Indians saw this place without the influence of other man. And while pollution and all the other factors are there, I mean, San Jose Island was my place. Looking back in time, I know how lucky I am to have seen what I did.
Yeah, and David, you've been here for 20 years now. You're coming up on 20 years at the Collar Times. I mean, what are your observations of how it's changed in just 20 years?
Well, I don't have the luxury of Chuck's perspective, but I know many folks have tried to get conservation a handle on it down here, and I know one person said when we were going through the seagrass wars that the 15-year boat loan probably had more to do with the recklessness of behavior on the water, just because more people could come, and then the shallow draft boats got people into areas where they'd never gone before, couldn't have gone before. Of course, airboats can go, but very few people have airboats. The shallow draft boats got people into the backwaters, and they felt like if they could go there, they should go there. And where Chuck might park his boat and get out and walk, these guys, you know, thought, well, my boat will go in there, so I'm going. And that kind of water movement and the hydrology and stuff like that, we started digging trenches and uprooting seagrasses and cordgrasses and, you know, where Spartina banks were at one point, there aren't anymore. And that changes the whole hydrology. And his science background enlightened me on some of that. And he has a pretty good tenure here with the perspective that I don't have. And so I piggyback on his perspective. I do know misbehavior when I see it, though.
Yeah.
And that's what I think needs to be curbed. But if you tell people why, I believe that they'll comply.
Well, and that's a perfect segue to what we were doing today. And Chuck, you want to describe I understand that this is the first big restoration project that Flatsworthy has done in its relatively brief history. So describe what we did today, Chuck.
We had built a relationship that I thought was really healthy with the people at the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge. Different factors led us to the hierarchy there. And so in that relationship, we talked about things that we didn't like and they didn't like. And then they discovered a artificially created diversion channel in the east pocket of St. Charles that cut across Blackjack Peninsula into Aransas Bay. And it diverted water from the natural mouth through this channel and across some really sensitive marshland where, you know, all aquatic life starts, shrimp, crab. Well, the shrimp don't start there, but they mature there.
And critical habitat.
Habitat for the whooping crane. And this channel was going to affect the lifespan of that and the health of that, and it had to be fixed. And we just stepped up the plate and said, we want to help. So that was the project, too.
And a lot of folks, including David Neslani.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they're responsible. They really are. They stepped up, he and his two boys and two other airboaters, and they came together, five airboats, and moved 400 bags of shell over and put it in. We couldn't have done it without them, but they did it gladly.
Yeah.
And they did it, I think they were proud to be a part of this deal. So that's how you change all the culture. We had wade fishermen there, fly fishermen there, lure fishermen there. And so everybody comes together with a common goal of making something better than that. That carries on into their thinking about the habitat too. And that's what the project is to fix that, but to create an awareness that what we do out here has an effect on the environment, and we have to be careful.
Yeah. I was talking to Wade Harrell out mm-hmm. there when we were out there on the site. He's the whooping crane recovery.
Whooping crane recovery
coordinator.
They're the pink ones.
with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But I asked him about the project, and uh-huh. he said, this simply, we couldn't have done it. He said, this would not have been fixed. This problem would not have been solved had this project not happened, because there's so many other issues and so many other priorities. And of course, as every day goes by and every month goes by, that channel would just get wider and wider and wider. And become more expensive to fix. So he talked about how that it wouldn't have been fixed had y'all not come to the table.
Well, I'm glad they feel that way, because I feel like that we've never had, the fishermen in Rockport have never had the relationship with the managers and the personnel at the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge if it wouldn't have been for Flatsworthy. I mean,
I agree, you're right. They are not the best at community outreach. And they kind of stay into themselves. So the fact that you reached out to them, and that was a big role of the ambassador that had to take place, because they embraced it immediately.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they like, thank you, you know. And I think that their buy-in, you know, I mean, the whooping cranes is a great flagship kind of, you know, icon that we can protect. It's a little more difficult to talk about fragmentation of a marsh. You know, unless you really see it, the future, and you start talking about next generation, But we always thought that this project was going to take a generation to kind of change culture. So we never saw it as a quick fix.
Well, I know, David, you're going to be writing about, you're here today, you know, because you covered this, what they did today. What is your perspective about what happened today?
Well, today obviously was a benchmark day. I mean, it is, we've had this kind of cooperation once before, about 3 days before Hurricane Harvey hit. The refuge got David Nesloney and the airboat, same crew pretty much that was here today.
Yeah, but expanded.
And we put up signs showing people where the boundaries of the refuge is, which really a lot of people probably would not have even known. Now, granted, the signs did prohibit entry, but I think that's going to soften over time, because what he's trying to prohibit is misbehavior. Well, we put up way more than a sign today. You can't go over a shell bag barrier in a boat.
400 bags.
Yeah, you're not going to do that easily, or you'll pay the price. So, you know, and I think the fact that some of the folks who are able to get back there in their airboats were the ones who put that barrier there is going to go a long way toward enforcement.
Well, it's... I had a good thought and it slipped right away.
These things happen.
I'm learning that at my age. I called my wife, oh, what's her name? You know, I can't remember it half time. But, I lost my train of thought. I know what it is. It came back to me. Did you feel the lightning bolt? I think it proved to the refuge that we're here to stay. Hurricane Harvey, we were going to do this in September before the Hoopin' Cranes got here, and of course Harvey interrupted everything down here. But we came back and we made the project work, and I think the refuge will know that we're serious, and a great experience was with Goose Island State Park personnel. I told my wife, I said, and her name's Marguerite. Hey, Marguerite, I said your name. I forgot it was old, what's her name? But anyway, so I told her the other night, I said, you know, all of these things are wonderful experiences for me, because in the past, I get my truck here, I take the boat over, launch it, go fish, come in and leave. And this made me stop and talk to the personnel over there and see how dedicated that T.J. Hinojosa and Russell Jackson and all of those personnel, how dedicated to that park they are, how serious they are about the whole environment, how they supported this project because of what we were doing. We weren't doing it on their property, but they opened the gates to us. They made it very simple, and they made me stop and realize what a resource that is for all of us over there, and I plan to get more involved in Goose Island State Park. I appreciate it in a different way.
That's great to hear. And I wanted to talk about Hurricane Harvey. You brought up Hurricane Harvey. I haven't been to Rockport in 5 years. This is the first time I have been here in 5 years.
You missed the worst of it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I know I have, and certainly we've followed it, but it's still shocking. It's shocking to see the downed trees, the buildings without roofs. To talk to folks, you know, in the community that I know are still reeling from that. And Chuck, what are your observations about, you know, where we are now? What is it, 9 months out from the storm?
I think we probably sobered up from a really bad binge drinking. You know, everybody is, I don't know, you see the change, and you're over the fact that, you know, like here at my house, I lost 15 trees, and that changed the landscape of the whole landscape of Rockport and the surrounding area has been changed. And people are staying, and, you know, some people were forced to leave. There's a lot of opportunity to help people. And I think, like, the foundation project to go and restore the Fulton Pier is a wonderful deal. You cannot, no entity can come down here and fix all of this. You have to pick a project that's in keeping with your mission statement and put blinders on, go do the best you can in that project, make a difference in that project, feel sorry for the rest of them, but don't get hung up on the big picture.
Yeah. Well, and I have to interrupt you and just kind of explain a little bit. We're talking about the Fulton Pier, Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation.
Correct.
That's going to be raising money.
Correct.
We're going to be project managing that. We're going to be working with the city to get that pier back up and running as quickly as possible. Okay. I can't speak to the timeline. I do know that we'll be raising funds. So anyone out there listening, we are raising funds. If you want to donate, please contact us and let us know about that.
It's important. That's just the poor man's pier, and everybody that that's for. I don't know. Rockport's a real diverse economy of haves and have-nots, and everybody deserves a recreational facility, and that's certainly one that anyone can go enjoy, and. That's what's critical to the recovery of Rockport, is getting people to come back down here and realizing that, you know, it's not dead, it's on the way back, and it's going to be slow and steady, and it's not going to happen overnight. But come down here and support this thing.
How's the fishing right now?
fishing, truthfully, it's really good when we don't have a north wind blowing 40 miles an hour, and the temperature dropping down to burr, but fish in the spring are real sensitive to temperature differentials, and all, this is just we went from winter to, we're going to probably just go straight to summer. The spring just wasn't a typical spring, but there's a lot of nice fish, and the one thing that Harvey did that thinks really healthy is it took all of the water and all the bottoms, and it agitated them and got stagnant water in a healthy, and mixing with healthy water, and everything's just, to me, it's in way better condition now than it was before the storm. There's always something good and something bad.
Always.
Yeah, it really is.
David, what are your observations about Hurricane Harvey recovery?
Well, I've done a lot of stories on the people that in the face of the hurricane are fighting back, and they really are some great people down here helping each other. A lot of people, were relying on some aid, but the helping each other part was great. There's a group called Samantha McCrary and her husband and the Rockport Relief Camp. They had like, I don't know how many people, 80, 90 people staying in tents and RVs on their property. And she was feeding, in some cases, 1,000 meals a day to these people. And I mean, it was just an open door. You could come, didn't have to show a driver's license or that you lived here or anything. And she's one of the people that represent the spirit of this town. You can still go around town and see thumbing their nose at Harvey, and the spring fling event that the Chamber of Commerce did, we just had that a couple of weeks ago, and we all stayed at the inn at Fulton Harbor because he owns Charlotte Plumbers as well, and those two businesses were some of the first ones that came back, and yet he was still contributing thousands of dollars to some of the relief efforts to fill the gaps in the services that the government wasn't. And the fishing, I've done more fishing stories in Rockport than I have down in Laguna Madre lately. So I did my first croaker story the other day. Aren't you proud of me?
I am proud. I'm always proud of you, David. I'll never say anything different because he'll put it in writing. He'll document what he really thinks about it.
You guys have fished together a lot, right?
We have.
Tell me about
that. I don't remember the first year, but it was probably in 99 or so, I guess. I mean, at least then. And I really didn't know much about fly fishing. And I knew Chuck because he had a reputation, a good one. Back then, and I don't remember, he had a little Hell's Bay or something, and we were back there. Was that what you had back then?
I don't know.
And I think you had another person on, but he was going to babysit me that day, and so we got out of the boat and we were waiting, and it was just shoulder to shoulder, and he was pointing out fish to me, and of course I'd go, what fish? And finally I figure out there was a fish in front of me, and then I had to try and cast to it, and I can't cast worth a darn, and I especially can't cast when Daddy, he's sitting there over my shoulder telling me, that it's right there, just right there, And I think I did end up catching a couple of fish that day, but I learned right then that, my urge to please Chuck has always been one of those deals when I'm out there, when I have the fly rod in my hand, because usually I'm just writing about other people. He's much easier to photograph than he is to be taught by.
But, so noted. So, hey, has he gotten any better?
No, I haven't. The last time we fished, I think Larry McKinney was probably on us a couple years ago, and I think Larry and I each caught one little old redfish, and he just was shaking his head the whole day. He showed us more redfish than any person should see in a day, and I think we ended up catching one. Well, I also broke out my Bubba stick one day. He calls my bait caster my Bubba stick, and I actually said I need a redfish picture, so I caught one with my Bubba stick, and we got a photograph of the fish.
Now you're telling
that's okay.
Telling the inside story your article.
We were with Mr. Hogan, I think that day.
Okay,
I think
all right.
We were, yeah. But he ended up catching fish.
Yeah.
So you know, it's always fun to go with Chuck, you know, because anytime somebody will pull you around, have you seen his arms? Anytime somebody will pull you around in a poling skiff all day, you're like, I'll do that. Yeah, I think I'll do that, because he does all the work.
No, it's not work. It's fun. You know, a good trip is being with somebody you like, and having him learn something that'll help him the next trip. It's not about how many you caught.
No.
It just isn't. But,
especially
you know,
when you're with David.
I learned how inept I was.
I'm not going to say a word. I've learned that comes back later when you don't expect it.
Like in the Sunday edition of the Corpus Christi Caller Times, right?
Yeah. But anyway.
Well, Chuck,
I got to say something about David Desilone. You know, I brought his name up, and I love David Desilone. He's Rockport. He and I go back, and when I said it was just he and I back there, it was. I observed redfish that were undisturbed by man and their movement in the series of lakes. And when somebody else comes along, then you start altering the natural movement and progression of fish feeding in that environment. So it wasn't anything bad about David. I can go to bed at night and I'll be so mad at David Desilone, and I love him the next 3 weeks, you know. He's a good guy, and he's been so supportive of what we're trying to do. And he's in a precarious position. He's the leader of the airboaters, and you know, not all of them like me. They don't.
I've heard that. No, I'm kidding.
No, I mean they don't. But you know, that's the way it is. But David stayed the course, and he's been loyal, and he's been straightforward and stand up guy.
And he was there today.
You bet.
That's right. Leading the charge.
Yep.
Yeah.
As always.
And that says a lot. That says a lot.
It says everything.
And there was a bunch of people with his last name there, too.
Yes, there were.
His twin sons were
they
there.
They were.
So this was the first project for Flatsworthy. What's next? What's coming up for Flatsworthy?
I think what we need to do is fall back. This project, you know, has taken a lot of our energy. And it's going to yield a camaraderie that's really healthy for Flatsworthy. And what we need to go back and do is we need to have a public meeting. And we need to reiterate our initial goals of respect for each other and the habitat. And also we need to bring the wildlife refuge people in for clarification on some of their interpretation of their mission statement, and I think that'll be forthcoming. But I want to take a break for at least a month and have a public meeting.
I want to kind of wrap this up, because one other thing that you're involved with Parks and Wildlife is the We Will Not Be Tamed campaign that's underway right now.
That's correct.
Why are you involved with that?
Well, I don't get asked to do very many things, you know. No, I love the Parks and Wildlife, and I love the foundation. I've got so many friends that are on the foundation board. They're clients of mine on the foundation board. So, you know, when you're my age and living out here in Lamar and get asked to do something in the limelight, you go, I'll be happy to do that. I'm at the end of my career, so if I can give back to the institutions that have created this environment for me to move around in, then I should do it. So that's my fault.
Well, we appreciate your time with that. And David, yeah. And David, we appreciate your time today too. Really appreciate you being here. And I would like to mention that I'm going to be writing about this project in the Texas Land Magazine in their summer issue. So folks out there can read more about what happened today and about Chuck and Rockport in that upcoming issue of Texas Land Magazine. So thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. That's it.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.